We begin this hour with a story that shows how quickly the landscape is shifting in Iraq. 2 months ago, NPR visited the Christian village of Al-Kosh in northern Iraq. It's about 30 miles from Mosul. Then the village was swarming with displaced Iraqis, Muslims, Christians, and others who fled Mosul when the city was captured by the extremists calling themselves the Islamic State. Well, now, as NPR's Peter Kenyon reports, the Good Samaritans of Al-Kosh need saving themselves.
In June, Al-Kosh was humming with activity. The schools were full of displaced Shiite Muslims, and spare rooms in many homes were filled with fleeing Christian families. But this week, on a recent sun-baked afternoon, the village was desolate. Al-Kosh sits at the base of a mountain, home to a monastery dating from the 6th century. These days, much of the village is as quiet as that monastery. A few Kurdish security forces stand guard at the entrance, mainly concerned with keeping potential looters away from the tidy stone and cement houses. As Kurdish forces retake villages around Mosul, families have begun to trickle back to Al-Kosh, but most stay only during the day, with Islamic State forces only some 20 miles away. Rad Salman is one of the few who's here full-time, for now. The 45-year-old truck driver has a recent history that's sadly familiar to many Iraqis.
We're originally from Baghdad. We fled Baghdad. My father and brother were kidnapped. We paid a huge ransom, but they shot and badly wounded my brother. Now we're displaced for a second time.
Salman gestures to his large, well-appointed home, saying it took years of high-risk travel on Iraq's dangerous highways to earn the money for it. But now he's resigned to leaving it behind, as well as centuries of Christian history here, because his family's safety comes first.
Believe me, there is nowhere in Iraq that is safe for us. We have Shiite friends in the city of Kut. They say, come live with us, we'll keep you safe. They're good friends, but what about the future? They could be the next ones displaced.
Salman doesn't know where they'll go. Their passports are expired, and he says he doesn't have much hope of renewing them. A deep current of fear is once again running through Iraq's Christian minority, which is believed to have numbered around 1.5 million when America invaded Iraq in 2003. Now estimates range from 200,000 to 400,000. In June, NPR spoke with Rinam Mansour, a 30-year-old teacher who was volunteering to help displaced people from Mosul. Now he sits on his couch, pondering his own future.
I was on the church's commission to help displaced people. They were Shiites, Christians, and others, and we opened our doors and gave them what we could. And now, we ourselves are the displaced.
In numerous interviews with displaced Yazidis, another religious minority in Iraq, many said they envy the Christians because they have a church to stand up for them. But Mansour just laughs when he hears this.
The church protect us? The church people were the first ones to leave. Maybe Al-Kosh used to be a strong Christian village, but now most people want to leave Iraq. I think only those families with no money, no passports, or no friends to help them relocate will stay.
Mansour's sister Lillian has already tried relocating, having been moved by the UN to Southern California after the last anti-Christian violence in 2008. It was during the U.S. recession, though, and when neither she nor her husband could find any kind of work, they returned to northern Iraq.
When we got back, it took my husband over a year to find work. And then at least things were better than in America. But just a few months later, all this started.
As luck would have it, Lillian's husband found work as a teacher in one of the minority villages around Mount Sinjar that was soon to be terrorized by Islamic State fighters. Now Mansour says the best-case scenario for him is to give up his home and the relative prestige of teaching and hope to find a menial job in a strange country. He believes that if Iraqi Christians are to survive, it won't be in Iraq. Peter Kenyon, NPR News in northern Iraq.
Let's follow along now with a crowd of people. They flowed into a church last night in Ferguson, Missouri.
Stephanie, thanks for coming out. Can I
they said hello to NPR's Michelle Martin, who moderated a community meeting in a small city that was the scene of a police shooting and then weeks of sometimes violent protest. St. Louis Public Radio convened the event, attended by more than 200 people, from the mayor to many young people. This morning we will hear some of the discussion and talk with the person who was asking the questions. Michelle Martin is with us from St. Louis. Hi, Michelle.
Hi, Steve.
So what were you trying to do?
Well, as you said, I was invited by St. Louis Public Radio to moderate the conversation, and I thought that in that role, my job was to help everybody have a good conversation. And by good, you know, I meant a conversation where everybody felt heard, that people really felt that they were talking to each other. And at times, I will tell you, that was hard because feelings ran very high. But we did it, and I think it was very powerful.
Why in a church?
Well, in part because the pastor there really impressed a lot of people with his willingness to be in the mix. I mean, he spent a lot of hours out on the street. I mean, there was a photograph of him that was captured that really went viral. He talked with our colleague Melissa Block about it, where he was literally putting his body in between a young man who seemed very angry and upset and a police officer. He spent, you know, hours on the street trying to diffuse tensions. And this was his church. And he saw this kind of as an opportunity to offer a safe space for people to have some difficult conversations.
And it sounds like every kind of person came to that church last night.
Well, you know, that was one of the things that stood out for me, Steve, is that this was a very diverse crowd. One young African-American woman told me after the event that this was the most people that she had seen participating in a conversation like this, particularly around this issue. Also, the crowd initially was in fact largely white and older, but as the evening wore on, more and more young people started to come, and they made it very clear that they wanted to be heard. One of them said, "Look, I'm in church. Let me give you my testimonial." A number of them talked about being harassed and even injured by the police in recent weeks. One young man even pulled up his shirt to show where a rubber bullet had hit him, and another young woman did the same. And I also want to play a short clip from one of the young women who came and spoke with us. She's a 20-year-old college student, and her name is Alexis Stumbleton.
What's still going on? Take this opportunity to tell what's most important for the mayor to know right now.
For the mayor to know right now is that the people that are up under you are directly taking our rights away. I can't explain to you that my First Amendment rights have been taken away, and that I have been told directly by a police officer that I don't have this right when I know for a fact I do. I was told that I did not have the right to assemble, and I know for a fact, you know for a fact, we all know for a fact that we have the right to assemble.
Well, she was talking about two things here, Steve. One is that, you know, as you know, there has been a lot of criticism about the way that law enforcement here handled those demonstrations, that many people feel that they used heavy-handed and even abusive tactics to address largely peaceful demonstrations, and many, many people feel that they escalated the situation. But she was specifically addressing herself to the mayor of Ferguson, James Knowles, who was there throughout the evening. And I think that that's important to note because he has not had very many public appearances, and in fact, he's been heavily criticized by people for not being very visible during this crisis. And a number of the young people there specifically wanted to address him. They wanted to ask him why he was not more visible and what he was going to do to address their concern. In fact, one person specifically told him that he should step down, and he was very emphatic that he would not. But it was interesting to me to see that particularly a number of the young people felt it was important to hold him accountable for his leadership, and they wanted to let him know that they did not feel that he heard them and was representing them or even really understood them.
We should remind people the mayor is white, the majority of the community is black. A lot of people were black at this meeting that you moderated, but you mentioned, Michelle, there were a lot of white people there too. What were they saying?
Well, I'm glad you mentioned that, too, because I want to say that it wasn't just the African-American constituents, residents of Ferguson, who were expressing frustration about the quality of leadership that they were seeing throughout this crisis. I want to play you a clip from a woman named Emily Davis, who is white. She said she's a mother of three. She said that when this first happened, she first felt deep sorrow, but now she felt angry because she was very disappointed in the leadership that she was seeing from the community and from leadership in general, but particularly from the police. I just want to play a short clip of that.
My kids are confused. My son said, "I thought police were the good guys." And my feeling is that no mother should have to fear for her son's life every time he leaves home.
That's a painful thought to hear.
It is, and I think that one of the things that emerged for a number of the white residents who came to the meeting was a number of people shared that they were surprised by the level of pain, fear, and anger that were regularly experienced by their African-American neighbors. In fact, one man who is white told us that his son has an African-American friend, and they were talking about, you know, recent events, and the African-American friend was talking about how, you know, when he rides his bike over to their house, how he is stopped by the police and people ask, you know, where did you get that bike and can you prove that you own that bike? And they had no idea. They had no idea that he was experiencing this kind of thing. You know, speaking of the police, Steve, I have to tell you that Daniel Isom was also there. He was just named Missouri's Director of Public Safety by Governor Nixon. He's a former chief of police in St. Louis and has been teaching criminology and public safety in the interim. And he is African-American. He will also be the only African-American in Governor Nixon's cabinet going forward. He starts his job next week.
What did he have to say to people who expressed such deep and widespread concerns about police behavior?
He seemed to be very moved by what he was hearing. I don't want to say shaken by it, but I do want to say he seemed very disturbed. As I mentioned, he's been teaching, so he was very professorial in some ways. I mean, he was kind of explaining police philosophy and their philosophy around handling certain situations. But I will tell you that one of the more powerful moments in an evening full of powerful moments came when he specifically criticized the way that Michael Brown's remains were handled. As you may remember, many people were very upset about the fact that 18-year-old Michael Brown's body lay in the street for quite some time after the shooting in view of many, many people, including members of his family. I mean, people were very upset about that and felt it was very disrespectful. And he very pointedly said that this was a mistake. It was a mistake from the standpoint of law enforcement. And he said, I believe that it was a mistake from just the standpoint of human relationships. I think that a lot of people in the audience were appreciative of someone in authority saying that it was wrong. And I will note that many people in the audience were very disappointed that the mayor himself did not make such a statement, nor did he really seem to apologize for the hurt that was experienced by people who were specifically upset by this.
Michelle, you mentioned that this was all taking place in a church where the pastor is Willis Johnson, known to many of our listeners for a very moving interview that he gave. What did he have to say?
Well, he expressed the desire that people would start talking to each other as opposed to about each other. And I'll just play a clip of what he had to say. Here it is.
We need to dare to care. We need to defy convention. But most of all, we need to demonstrate some commitment. And just coming here tonight is not enough. Just going out in the streets for the last 12 or 13 days, going up and down, whether that was just holding your hands or throwing tear gas back or just yelling, is not enough. We've got a long struggle ahead of us. We've got great work to do.
You know, obviously, this is not a representative group. Everybody who came to this conversation chose to be part of this community conversation. But I really sensed a desire on the part of those 200 people there to continue that dialogue. And I certainly hope that happens.
Michelle, thanks very much.
Thank you.
That's NPR's Michelle Martin. And if you want to hear more of this town hall meeting, it's being broadcast locally in St. Louis on St. Louis Public Radio. And they're also streaming it on the web at noon today.